2. The Evolution of 80-20 Running. The greatest runner of the 19th century was an Englishman named Walter George. In 1886, George set a world record of 4 minutes 12.75 seconds for the mile that stood for 29 years. Among the greatest runners today is Mo Farah, also an Englishman by way of Somalia. In 2013, Farah set a British record of 3 minutes 28.81 seconds for 1,500 meters, equivalent to 3 minutes 44 seconds for the mile. That's almost half a minute, or 11% faster than Walter George's mark. Why are today's runners so much faster than those of the past? There's more than one reason. Much has changed in the sport over the past 150 years. In Walter George's time, only a handful of nations were serious about running, whereas today the sport is truly a global phenomenon. The talent pool has grown astronomically. There are technological differences as well. George raced on dirt and grass. Farah competes on advanced rubberized surfaces. The biggest difference, however, is training. Early in his career, George ran no more than 10 miles per week. Even when he set his long-standing mile record, he was averaging just 3 or 4 miles a day. Mo Farah started his career at 70 miles per week and moved up to 120 miles. This enormous difference in total running volume masks an even greater disparity in low-intensity running volume. Of the 25 miles Walter George ran in a typical week at his peak, 16 were done at low intensity. Of the 120 miles Mo Farah runs in a typical week, close to 100 are done below the ventilatory threshold. So while Farah does just over 2.5 times more fast running than George did, he does 6 times more slow running. If Walter George had been able to run on a rubberized track, and if he had enjoyed a higher level of competition, he certainly would have run the mile faster than 4 minutes 12 seconds, but not a whole lot faster. There's only so much you can achieve on less than 4 miles of running per day. Likewise, even with the advantages of modern competition and technology, Mo Farah would not have been able to run anywhere near the equivalent of a 3-minute 44-second mile on Walter George's training regimen. Differences in training methods clearly account for most of the improvement in race times that we have seen between the late 19th century and today. Walter George's training methods were typical of his era, as are Mo Farah's of the present. The transition from the standard training system of the Victorian age, which featured small amounts of slow and fast running, to the modern training system, which is characterized by large quantities of slow running and modest doses of fast running, did not occur suddenly. It happened inch by inch, the way animals evolve. In fact, the sport of running has much in common with evolution. Life on Earth is a game of survival of the fittest. So is running, in a slightly different sense. In life, genetically unique organisms compete to produce offspring. Genes that help an organism survive are likely to be passed on to future generations of the species, while genes that hinder survival tend to get weeded out. Over time, the species becomes increasingly adapted to its environment. In running, athletes build fitness with disparate methods and then come together to compete in races. The training methods used by race winners are frequently copied by the losers, who cast aside their own inferior methods. Over time, this process generates an always improving set of best practices that in turn produces ever fitter and faster runners. The two most important variables in run training are volume, how much you run, and intensity, how fast you run. These two variables have been combined in every conceivable way over the past 150 years. There have been low-volume, low-intensity runners, high-volume, low-intensity runners, low-volume, high-intensity runners, and high-volume, high-intensity runners. Each of these general approaches has encompassed a full range of permutations. The particular high-volume, low-intensity combination of 100 to 120 miles of running per week and 80% of total running time at low intensity was first tried by elite runners in the 1950s. By the late 1960s, it had driven virtually every other way of combining volume and intensity into extinction, and it remains in almost universal use by today's elite runners. In short, the 80-20 method has won the survival of the fittest, and there's nothing left to try. Let's see how it happened. The Intervals Era. In July 1948, a successful Finnish businessman named Paavo Nurmi visited the Olympic Training Center in Uxbridge, England, a few days before the opening of the London Games. Nurmi was interested in watching the middle and long distance runners train. Among those whose workouts he witnessed was Emil Zatopek, a previously unheralded 25-year-old Czech soldier who had recently come within 2 seconds of breaking the world record for 10,000 meters, which Nurmi himself had once held. He stared in astonishment as Zatopek ran 5 times 200 meters in 34 seconds, jogging briefly after each sprint, then ran 20 times 400 meters in times ranging from 56 to 75 seconds, again jogging between intervals, and finally ran another set of 5 200-meter sprints. It was the hardest workout Nurmi had ever witnessed, and he had witnessed his share. At the Olympics the following week, Zatopek won a gold medal in the 10,000 meters and took silver in the 5,000. Upon returning to Finland, Nurmi urged the runners of his nation to emulate Zatopek's methods, declaring that this athlete alone understood the meaning of hard training. Here's a prime example of evolution at work in the sport of running. A young runner had come up with a novel training method that was different from what the established top runners of the day were doing. He then defeated those top runners in a major international competition. Afterward, the losers were encouraged to copy the winners' methods, which would become the new standard until another young runner came up with something better still. Paavo Nurmi probably wished he were 20 years younger and could put Zatopek's methods to use himself. At the peak of his career, Nurmi had run 40 miles and walked 25 miles per week. This was more than the runners who came before him had done, and it was enough to make him the greatest runner in history. Known as the Flying Finn, Nurmi earned 9 individual gold and silver medals in 3 Olympics between 1920 and 1928 and set numerous world records. Interestingly, Nurmi had been a rather mediocre runner until he added a relatively new method of training, high-intensity intervals, to his program. Workouts such as 6 times 400 meters in 60 seconds triggered a performance breakthrough that made the Flying Finn almost unbeatable for several years. After he retired, though, Nurmi looked back on his career with regret, wishing he had done more interval work. "The greatest mistake I made, and which was formerly made in general, was the one-sided training program. Too much long, slow running," he told his biographer. He would live long enough until 1973 to discover the error of this assessment. If there is one thing Emil Zatopek did not do, it was too much long, slow running. Zatopek was training much like the other young Czech runners of his generation, a few miles of easy jogging each day, when a buddy introduced him to the interval method in 1943. It was a eureka moment for him. "Why should I practice running slow?" he would later recall thinking. "I must learn to run fast by practicing to run fast." Zatopek traded his 5-mile jogs for a daily interval workout consisting of 10 sprints of 100 or 200 meters plus 6 hard intervals of 400 meters. Plenty of other runners were doing intervals in those days, but Zatopek did nothing but intervals. And as time went by, he did more and more of them. His logic was simple. If a few intervals were good, more must be better. Each year, Zatopek increased his volume of interval training another step. The harder he trained, the faster he got. In 1949, he set a new world record of 29 minutes and 2.6 seconds for 10,000 meters. 2 years later, he ran the fastest time in history for a 20K. In 1952, he won 4 gold medals at the Olympics in Helsinki. Still not satisfied, he continued to ratchet up his training load. By 1954, Zatopek was doing workouts that made the mind-blowing session Paavo Nurmi had witnessed at Uxbridge seem like a warm-up in comparison. He now ran 50 times 400 meters at race intensity, and during peak training periods, he completed this heroic session 2 times a day every day. It added up to more than 140 miles per week, including recovery jogs, which accounted for only a third of the total volume. That year, Zatopek set world records at 5,000 meters, 13 minutes and 57.2 seconds, and again at 10,000 meters, 28 minutes, 54.2 seconds. The next winter, Zatopek tried to raise his game another notch. In February, he ran as much as 180 miles in 1 week, but this time, more intervals did not yield better performance. "I'm no good this year," Zatopek, then 33 years old, announced after a series of lackluster results. He had exceeded the maximally effective dose of interval training. He had found his limit. Zatopek could at least take consolation in knowing that his personal limit far surpassed that of any other living runner. As early as 1950, Athletics Weekly editor Jimmy Green had written, "Zatopek is, of course, a law unto himself when it comes to training, and no athlete would be wise to emulate his colossal amount of severe work. It combines the fast-slow work with punishing severity. The quantity and severity of his training and racing are such that it was fully anticipated he would not last for more than a couple of years at the same rate, but the Czech is still running and still breaking records." Green was right about one thing. Zatopek was a law unto himself. Few of the runners who tried to match his murderous workload were able to, and perhaps only one runner, the Russian Vladimir Kuts, benefited from it as much as Zatopek himself had. Half a decade younger than his idol, Kuts used high-volume interval training to win gold medals at 5,000 and 10,000 meters at the 1956 Olympics and set world records at both distances. But his career was short. Zatopek's brutal regimen fried the legs off Kuts in less than 5 years. Although his speed-based training system had taken the sport forward from where it had stood when Zatopek found it, that system proved to be a dead end. He had shown that high-intensity intervals were a vital ingredient in the training of distance runners, but in the final analysis, it seemed their place was rather smaller than Zatopek and Normie had anticipated. If future generations of runners were going to run even faster, they would have to do so by some means other than speed-based training. Marathons for milers. When Emil Zatopek got the idea that lots of fast running was the key to maximum performance, he was working in a shoe factory in the city of Zlin, Czechoslovakia. Halfway around the world, and a couple of years later, in 1945, in one of history's uncanny coincidences, Arthur Lydiard was working in a shoe factory in Auckland, New Zealand. When he came up with the idea that the key to maximum fitness was lots of slow running. Lydiard was then 27 years old, married, and a new father. In his free time, he played club-level rugby and also jumped into the occasional track race for laughs, never running farther than a mile at a time in training. One day, Lydiard was cajoled into running 5 miles, much further than was his wont, by Jack Dolan, a central figure in the Auckland running community and a man on a mission to inspire young runners of promise to take the sport more seriously. If Lydiard had performed well in this workout, it probably wouldn't have made a ripple in his life. But as it turned out, he got his ass kicked. Lydiard would later say that the run nearly killed him. This was an overstatement, but it's no exaggeration to say that Lydiard was thoroughly humiliated by the experience, for he took great pride in his fitness, and he was quite a bit younger than Dolan. To have struggled so desperately to keep up with his middle-aged challenger in such a modest test of conditioning left a bitter taste in Lydiard's mouth, and he came away determined to erase it. Another person in Lydiard's place might have added a bit more rigor to the 15-minute track workouts he did a couple of times a week, but intuition led Lydiard in another direction. As a rugby player, he was accustomed to sprinting, and he had good raw speed. Lack of speed was not the cause of his humiliation. The problem was stamina. In fact, Lydiard decided, lack of stamina was also the reason he lost even shorter contests, including the half-mile and 1 mile track races in which he routinely got thumped by local studs like Norm Cooper and Bill Savidin. Lydiard had more than enough horsepower to beat those guys. What he did not have was the capacity to sustain his speed. This problem was not unique to him. Lydiard realized that no runner truly needed to get faster in order to race faster over middle and long distances, because no runner, regardless of how gifted or well-trained he was, could sustain anything close to his maximum speed for even half a mile. but some runners could sustain a greater percentage of their natural speed over long distances than others could. And it was those runners, not necessarily the fastest runners, who won races. Endurance was the true limitation in running. And if that was the case, Lydiard concluded, then training should emphasize endurance building. The process of getting in shape for races should be a lopsided effort to increase stamina to the point where a runner could run more or less forever. The secret to running faster was to run farther. Lydiard tested this idea first on himself. He started running every day. Once he was comfortable running every day, Lydiard bumped up the distance of his longest run to 12 miles. Before long, all of his runs were 12 miles. Still, he did not feel tapped out, so he continued to pile on the miles, eventually maxing out at 250 miles in a single week. That was obviously too much. 200 miles per week wasn't much better. Ultimately, Lydiard discovered that he felt strongest when he ran 100 to 120 miles per week and varied the distance of the individual workouts from day to day. A typical week after he'd gotten it all figured out appeared something like this. Monday, 10 miles. Tuesday, 15 miles. Wednesday, 12 miles. Thursday, 18 miles. Friday, 10 miles. Saturday, 15 miles. Sunday, 24 miles. Lydiard learned that no matter how tired he was from recent training, he could almost always manage to run again if he kept the pace slow. But he did not always run slowly. Lydiard played around with the intensity of his running almost as much as he did with the volume. These investigations taught him that speed work helped the most when it was sprinkled lightly on top of a huge foundation of slow running. In essence, he invented 80-20 training. Although Lydiard raced sparingly during his 9 years of experimentation, he raced better and better as he came closer and closer to perfecting his formula. He trained utterly alone through the better part of this period, but Lydiard's steadily improving results, which included national marathon championship titles in 1953 and 1955, and his boastful descriptions of the prodigious training distances that lay behind those results, inspired other runners to join him. His first regular training partner was Laurie King, a young novice who worked alongside Lydiard at the shoe factory. In his first year of low-intensity, high-volume training, King struggled to a 56th place in the Auckland Junior Cross Country Championship. A year later, he won the same race by 70 yards. A pattern was thus established that never changed. Lydiard's mostly slow approach did not work overnight, but runners who stuck with it improved steadily year after year. King went on to win the Senior New Zealand Cross Country Championship and even set a national record for 6 miles. Almost before he knew it, Lydiard was surrounded by a half dozen young men on epic long runs through the Waitakere Ranges west of Auckland, and they were no longer his training buddies. He was their coach. Among those who sought Lydiard out were Murray Helberg, who started running after a rugby injury crippled his left arm, Barry McGee, a teenager who had just lost his father to an industrial accident, and Peter Snell, a big bruiser with a neck wider than his head. They didn't look like much, but on Lydiard's 100 miles per week program, they began to win. By the Olympic year of 1960, Arthur's boys were celebrated and feared throughout New Zealand. As a collective, they had won at least one national championship, usually more, each year since 1954. 5 of them made the Olympic team. Helberg qualified for the Rome Games in both the 5,000 meters and the 10,000 meters. Snell made the team at 800 meters. McGee claimed a spot in the marathon. A couple of second-tier athletes in Lydiard's group, Ray Puckett and Jeff Julian, took New Zealand's other 2 marathon slots. In Rome, racing against runners conditioned on the currently dominant interval method, Arthur's boys won 3 medals, an unprecedented haul for the tiny country. Helberg took gold in the 5,000. Snell also claimed gold and set an Olympic record in the 800. McGee snagged the bronze in the marathon. Arthur's boys and their unconventional training methods were the story of the Rome Games. Evolution kicked in, and Lydiard's low-intensity, high-volume approach began to spread. Lydiard himself, an unabashed self-promoter, was the primary vehicle for the diffusion of his philosophy. In the spring of 1962, he wrote an article titled, "Why I Prescribe Marathons for Milers," for Sports Illustrated. "In theory," Lydiard explained, "I am trying to develop my runners until they are in a tireless state. In practice, this means I am trying to give them sufficient stamina to maintain their natural speed over whatever distance they are running. Stamina is the key to the whole thing, because you can take speed for granted. No, look here. Everybody thinks a 4-minute mile is terrific, but it is only 4 1-minute quarter miles. Practically any athlete can run a 1-minute quarter, but few have the stamina to run 4 of them in a row. How do you give them the necessary stamina? By making them run and run and run some more." Lydiard was in the United States when his Sports Illustrated article made its splash. He had been invited to tour the country for 3 months to deliver lectures at universities and anywhere else runners and coaches might gather. The first few events were standing room only, so the organizer extended the tour to 8 months, during which time Lydiard's revolt became a revolution. Over the next decade, a fascinating experiment was played out at the sport's highest level. Early adopters of the Lydiard system competed against speed-based training loyalists in all the big races, which became proxy battlefields where the two training systems struggled for dominance through their athletic avatars. Lydiard-style training finally won, but victory was not achieved overnight. At the 1964 Olympics in Tokyo, the men's 800 meters and 1500 meters were won by Peter Snell, one of Arthur's boys. The men's 5,000 meters was won by American Bob Shule, who practiced speed-based training. And the men's 10,000 meters was won by another American, Billy Mills, then a recent convert to the Lydiard system. Mills was an interesting case. He never won an individual NCAA title while running 30 miles per week for the University of Kansas. After graduating, Mills relocated to Houston, where he came under the influence of Pat Clohessy, an Australian runner and one of Lydiard's earliest disciples. In the lead-up to his stunning breakthrough at the Tokyo Games, Mills ran up to 90 mostly slow miles per week. Such stories inspired yet more runners to take a chance on the Lydiard system. By 1972, it was impossible for a runner with any amount of natural talent to win on the world stage with speed-based training. At the Olympic Games in Munich, the winners of the men's 800 meters, American Dave Waddle, 1500 meters, Finland's Pekka Vesala, 5,000 meters, Finland's Lasse Virran, and 10,000 meters, Virran again, were all adherents of the low-intensity, high-volume way. But even then, the Lydiard system had only begun to prove its might. The Boston Renaissance. During his 1962 tour of the United States, Arthur Lydiard made a brief stop in Des Moines, Iowa. Among those who attended Lydiard's lecture, there was Bill Squires, a former All-American miler at Notre Dame, who had just started coaching high school runners in Boston. He became an instant convert. When Squires returned to Boston, he brought Lydiard's ideas with him. 11 years later, Squires became the head coach of the newly created Greater Boston Track Club. Having gotten good results from Lydiard-style training with younger runners, he applied the same mostly slow approach with the adult members of the GBTC, many of whom had cut their teeth on speed-based training. The outcome was immediate success, which attracted new talent to the club, which resulted in even greater success, attracting still more talent. One of the first runners to join up was a 25-year-old hospital janitor named Bill Rogers. 18 months later, Rogers won the Boston Marathon with an American record time of 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 55 seconds. Under Squire's guidance, Boston Billy went on to claim 3 more Boston Marathon victories, lowering his American record to 2 hours, 9 minutes, 27 seconds in the 1979 race. He won the New York City Marathon 4 times as well. Table 2.1, found in the bonus PDF, offers a 7-day sample of Bill Rogers' training from 2 weeks before his first win in Boston. He ran 128 miles in those 7 days. It is impossible to accurately judge intensity from the information Rogers recorded, but my best guess is that the distances emphasized in boldface were run at or above the ventilatory threshold. If so, then Rogers completed 104 of his 128 miles for the week, or 81%, at low intensity. He did not know it, but he was following the 80-20 rule. In 1976, a talented local high school runner named Alberto Salazar joined the GBTC. 3 years later, at age 19, Salazar won the U.S. National Cross Country Championship. The second, fourth, and fifth place finishers in that race were also GBTC members. By that time, Salazar had left Boston to become a student at the University of Oregon, where he was coached by Bill Dellinger, one of the first apostles of the Lydiard system, having visited New Zealand to learn from the master in 1962. After graduating from Oregon, Salazar set American records for 5,000 meters, 13 minutes, 11.93 seconds, 10,000 meters, 27 minutes, 25.61 seconds, and the marathon, lowering Rogers' mark to 2 hours, 8 minutes, and 13 seconds. Another early member of the GBTC was Bob Savine, who had previously used speed-based training as a member of the Army Elite Team before switching to low-intensity, high-volume training under Bill Squires and discovering a whole new dimension of fitness. In 1983, Savine became the coach of Joan Benoit, still a raw talent at age 26, and taught her the same mostly slow training method that Squires had taught him and that Lydiard had taught Squires. On the strength of this method, Benoit won 3 Boston Marathon titles and the first Olympic women's marathon. She also set American records in the half marathon and marathon, and a world record at the latter distance. Perhaps the best proof of the potency of Lydiard's de facto 80-20 running system, as it was applied within the Greater Boston Track Club, was what it did for many runners of less talent than Rogers, Salazar, and Benoit. Take Dick Mahoney. Mahoney was working full-time as a mailman when he finished the 1979 Boston Marathon in 2 hours, 14 minutes, and 36 seconds. That time was good enough for 10th place, but it only got him 4th place among GBTC members, behind Rogers, the winner, Bob Hodge, 3rd in 2 hours, 12 minutes, and 30 seconds, and Tom Fleming, 4th in 2 hours, 12 minutes, 56 seconds. The GBTC fell back to earth in the early 1980s, when the sport became professionalized and the top runners were siphoned off by shoe companies. But by then, the low-intensity, high-volume training system that made the GBTC the most dominant running club the world has ever seen had spread across the country. No new method has come along since then to surpass the mostly slow approach. A survey of male and female runners who competed in the 2004 U.S. Olympic Team Trials men's and women's marathons revealed that the men did almost 3/4 of their training slower than their marathon race pace, while the women did more than 2/3 of their training at slower paces. At the elite level, marathon pace is just a notch above the ventilatory threshold, so the athletes involved in this survey were not far away from unconscious obedience to the 80-20 rule. The rise of Kenya. In 1983, a Greater Boston Track Club member, Greg Mayer, won the Boston Marathon for the first time. 5 years later, a Kenyan male won the event for the first time. Ibrahim Hussein's victory marked the dawn of the Kenyan dynasty in distance running. Incredibly, Kenyan men have won all but 7 runnings of the Boston Marathon since 88. Kenya's rise to supremacy in international running is looked back on as a story of overnight success that was made possible almost entirely by the Kenyan people's natural gift for running. But this view is not accurate. The first Kenyan runners to race internationally got spanked. In 1954, a pair of Kenyan runners took part in a London track meet. Nyandika Mayoro finished a distant 3rd in a 3-mile race, and Lazara Chepkwony failed to complete the 6-mile event. At the Sydney Olympics 2 years later, Mayoro took 7th at the 5,000 meters. Arir Enenchia failed to qualify for the 1,500-meter final, and Arapsum Kanuti finished 31st in the marathon. Kanuti was still the best athlete his country could muster for the Rome Games 4 years later, where he slid back to 59th place in the marathon. Kenyan runners would never have become the leading force in running that they are today if not for a fortuitous accident. British missionaries in Kenya endeavored to spread both Christianity and education there by building schools such as St. Patrick's High School in Iten, which opened its doors in 1961. Many of the children who attended these schools ran to and from class daily, motorized transportation being a luxury few could afford. The missionaries certainly had no intention of putting thousands of Kenyan boys and girls on a low-intensity, high-volume running program, but that's essentially what happened. When Arthur Lydiard visited Kenya for the first time in 1992, he was blown away by how much running the children there did for transportation. It was exactly what he would have required the children of his own country to do if he were charged with making New Zealand the most powerful running nation on earth. At the time of Lydiard's visit to Kenya, high-intensity interval training was enjoying a second life in the American high school system. Lydiard, of course, was horrified. After returning home, he wrote a letter to the magazine American Track and Field, in which he begged America's coaches to take a cue from East Africa. When Swedish physiologists went to observe and analyze the training methods of the Kenyan runners, Lydiard wrote, they found that high school girls and boys were running on average about 12 or 13 miles daily to and from school. Whereas the Africans would be running leisurely, trotting to and from school, their counterparts in the U.S. would be mostly on the track doing hard anaerobic repetitions. This is where the real problem lies. Jogging to school, though, was not enough to establish Kenya as a global powerhouse in the sport of running. It was also necessary that college-age and adult Kenyans start to use Lydiard-style training to prepare for elite competition. This didn't happen until the mid-1970s, when coaches at American universities initiated the practice of offering scholarships to gifted young Kenyan athletes. The first generation of Kenyan sporting émigrés included Henry Rono, who enrolled at Washington State University in 1976. After 2 years of low-intensity, high-volume training, Rono broke 4 world records in a span of 81 days. Lydiard-style training came to Kenya at about the same time. While Henry Rono was breaking records in Europe, an Irish missionary named Com O'Connell took over the running program at St. Patrick's High School. O'Connell had zero background as a running coach, but he boned up on the sport and wisely settled on a mostly slow approach with his young athletes. One of his first proteges was the previously mentioned Ibrahim Hussein, whose marathon training closely resembled that of Bill Rogers a decade before. There's a popular belief that Kenyan runners do much more training at moderate and high intensities than do elite runners from other places, but the hard data does not support this myth. In 2003, top French exercise scientist Véronique Bellat collected training data from 20 elite male and female Kenyan runners. A subsequent analysis of the data conducted by Stephen Saylor revealed that these runners did 85% of their running below the lactate threshold. Since the lactate threshold is slightly higher than the ventilatory threshold, these runners probably did very close to 80% of their training below the latter. Toby Tanser's book, More Fire, is a treasure trove of information about Kenyan training methods. Table 2.2 in the bonus PDF is borrowed from its pages. The table presents a sample week of training for Lorna Kiplagat, a legendary Kenyan runner who set a half marathon world record of 1 hour, 6 minutes, 25 seconds in 2007. I've taken the liberty of adding emphasis to the words easy, recovery, and warm-up to draw attention to just how large a fraction of her total mileage was run at low intensity. If we make the reasonable assumption that the efforts described with these terms fell below the ventilatory threshold, then like the American marathoners mentioned before, Kiplagat did about 80% of her training at low intensity, as all elite runners today do, Kenyans included. In 2011, the BBC sent former miler Eamon Coghlan to Kenya in search of the secret to their running dominance. In the first episode of the 3-part documentary, he met with Com O'Connell at St. Patrick's High School, where they watched a group of O'Connell's runners running slowly in single-file formation around and around a grass soccer field. "Is this still part of their warm-up?" Coghlan asked. "This is the workout," O'Connell said. "And they won't go any harder?" Coghlan asked. "This is it," O'Connell said. From mostly slow to 80-20. Training methods continue to evolve in the sport of running, but today's innovators are working at the margins, tinkering with different methods of incorporating cross-training, altitude training, and other such practices into their regimens. The biggest questions of how much and how fast to run appear to have been answered once and for all. With respect to these two key variables, Mo Farah's training in the second decade of the 21st century is not much different from Bill Rogers' training in the 1970s. Rogers ran upward of 120 miles per week, and Farah runs up to that amount. Rogers did about 80% of his running at low intensity, and Farah does the same. Yet while both knew their training distances, neither realized he was following the 80-20 rule. Runners routinely measure and track their volume, but they do not monitor their intensity distribution in the rigorous manner that scientists have begun to do. Every runner knows how many miles she ran last week, but does any runner know what percentage of his total running time for the past week was spent at heart rates below his individual ventilatory threshold? Because intensity distribution is not normally measured and tracked, elite runners like Mo Farah, who are clearly balancing the intensity of their training optimally, don't actually realize what they are doing quantitatively. They do, of course, consciously manipulate intensity in their training, but they tend to do so in terms of workout frequency, typically executing 10 slow runs and 2 or 3 faster runs per week. Rather than in terms of time spent in each intensity zone, only very recently have scientists analyzed the training data of elite runners and discovered that nearly all of them follow the 80-20 rule. That they do so without conscious awareness is a powerful indication that 80-20 running is truly optimal, because that's how evolution works, solving problems blindly. This kind of evidence does not satisfy most scientists, though. They want to see proof from traditional, controlled studies that the 80-20 rule works better than other ways of balancing intensities in training. This proof now exists, and it's piling up quickly. Most importantly, this new research proves that the 80-20 rule works not just for elite runners, but also for everyday runners like you and me.